AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Hal Herzog to talk about his book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, and Some We Eat. He's a maverick scientist and leader in the field of anthrozoology. His book is controversial, thought-provoking, and an unprecedented exploration of the psychology behind the inconsistent and often paradoxical ways we think, feel, and behave towards animals. Welcome to the show, Hal.
Well, thanks for having me on, Hannah.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me when and why you decided to put this book together, because it's a really, really interesting subject.
Well, I've been interested in our relationships with animals for a long time. And I found myself back 30, 40 years ago in some sort of morally complicated situations with animals. One was I found myself doing sort of an anthropological study of cockfighters that happened to have lived near where I lived. And the other was that I was an animal researcher at one time. And as I described in my book, I was in a situation where I wound up having to kill basically a phylogenetic scale of animals for some research purposes. And it caused me to begin to really think about our morally complicated views of other species and how we can make sense of them in a morally complicated world.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many questions out there that really get people thinking about their relationship with animals. I did the questionnaire that's part of your book, and it took me ages to do it because I was so conflicted. Exactly what you say. I mean, the biggest thing that kind of throws a spanner in the works, I think, is the whole idea of eating animals. And I myself am a meat eater, but I'm not hugely comfortable and proud of being so. There are plenty of people who believe that humans are supposed to eat meat and that's just the way it is, and feel totally comfortable with that fact. And then obviously you have vegans and people who are passionate about the fact that we should not be consuming animals at all. But then I think a lot of people fall in that kind of middle ground where they don't really want to know. And it's a bit kind of, it doesn't sit comfortably with them, the idea of doing so. And they just kind of make decisions without really knowing the background and the history of how this lump of meat has appeared on their plate.
That's exactly true. And I completely agree with you. I think of all of our paradoxical relationships with animals, that is the most complicated. And that's where we see the really quirky ways that people think. In fact, this has been called the meat paradox, the idea that on the one hand, we think of ourselves as animal lovers. And on the other hand, we love to eat them. You know, so for example, a study in the United States, as a survey done by a polling company, found that about half of Americans said that they agreed with the statement, animals should have the same right to live as people. But yet in the United States, over 95% of people regularly eat animals. In fact, a number of studies have shown amongst people that say that they're vegetarians, 60% of them eat some type of animal flesh every day. That's not every week.
Wow.
Every day.
That is shocking, isn't it? That really is. I think there's a huge amount of people who are, I'm trying to think of the right word to use, but they're very, well, as I was saying earlier, they don't kind of want to know where it comes from. They think of the meat on their plate as food. They don't think about where it's come from. They don't think that it's an animal, and don't want to think of it as an animal. It's kind of a separate thing. You know, you can be a dog lover, a cat lover, but then go out and enjoy a nice steak. And people don't like to put those two things in the same camp at all.
That's quite correct. And a really good example of that amongst people that even who do think about these issues was a study done recently of vegetarians. And a lot of vegetarians actually eat fish. And what these researchers did was they asked fish-eating vegetarians a question: do you think fish are made out of meat? And 40% of them said no.
Wow.
That they did not consider fish to be animals. That they considered, they basically put them in the plant category, which makes for a lot of moral convenience, you know. But it's but it's wacky.
It is. It's really interesting, and all the other different ways that that animals can be used, whether it's for testing on animals for cosmetics. I bet a lot of people would say that they disagree with animals of any sort being used for testing for cosmetic reasons and things like that. But I bet a lot of people, I go out on a limb and say most people are probably using cosmetics every day that are tested on animals.
That's quite true. And, you know, we're really seeing this, the whole business of using animals and testing and research. Animals are not being, are not tested as much in, you know, for cosmetic testing as they used to be. But because of COVID, we're actually seeing certain types of animal research that most people disapprove of. For example, research on primates, we're seeing that actually increase. So it turns out that monkeys are the best animal model for testing out COVID vaccines and things like that, let's say, as opposed to, you know, rats and mice. And so there's a big demand now for primates, which a lot of people are really opposed to. But on the other hand, I've had animal rights activists, friends tell me that they're opposed to any use of animals for the, you know, for the development of COVID vaccines. And at the same time, they told me, oh, I'm really excited. I'm getting my booster shot next week.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, with a lot of these things, whether it's to do with medical research or research for cosmetics or how animals are farmed and killed for meat or dairy consumption or whatever, there is a lot of information out there. And I think most people will choose not to look at that information because they couldn't deal with the reality as to what's going on, and then go, okay, I can see how that's happening. I don't like it, but I'm still going to go ahead and eat meat. It's kind of easier to not know, isn't it?
It's definitely easier to not know. And this is, there's a theory in psychology called cognitive dissonance theory, which says that, you know, if you come across, you know, ideas that are really conflicting, morally conflicting, and they conflict with the facts, that you either change your ideas, your moral ideas, or you ignore the facts or distort the facts. And we see that a lot in our interactions with animals. And I think a lot of people, you know, for, you know, they want to remain oblivious to the, for example, the number of animals that are used for our dining pleasure, because basically because they taste good. And the billions and billions and billions and billions. And then furthermore, as the interesting thing is that as we know more about the negative impact of, for example, industrial agriculture, animal agriculture on the environment, as we know more about the impact of animals on human health, the more animals we're eating. Meat consumption is going up in the world. It's not going down. In fact, it's going up quite a lot, quite rapidly.
Really? I thought people are eating less meat.
In the United, that most people think that, but if you look at worldwide animal consumption, it's going up a lot. And part of this is because as countries get richer, for example, in places like China, they want to eat more meat. Even in the United States, when Peter Singer wrote his groundbreaking book that started the animal liberation movement in 1975, the average American ate 170 pounds of meat per year. And now we're up to, if you include fish, we're up to 240 pounds of meat per year. And that number sort of varies a little bit. And the other thing is that the percentage of people that are vegetarians has not increased very much at all, surprisingly little. And furthermore, the vast majority of vegetarians and most vegans actually return to eating meat at some point in their life.
That is interesting. And I know, so my parents are vegan, and I know from personal experience what it is like to be a vegan, and also how passionate you can be as a vegan.
Yes.
and to not understand how people can have that conflict, you know, for people who are so passionate about caring for animals and have no desire at all and find it quite repulsive, the idea of eating an animal, can't get their head around, and I'm not talking about all vegans here, but some can't get their head around how other people can profess to be animal lovers and you know, be against certain things, certain ways on how animals are treated, but at the same time happily eat meat, wear leather, things like that. Like they just don't understand how people can be in that camp of being so conflicted.
That's absolutely true. And there was a study that, and that affects many aspects of your lives. And by the way, I admire vegans. I have friends that are vegans. I admire their sense of moral clarity, but also that and that they take these moral issues seriously and that they really walk the walk. They don't just talk. They actually change their life. On the other hand, there's some downsides to that. For example, there was a recent study that talked about the impact of going vegan on your romantic life. And so it turns out, yes, absolutely. So it turns out that not all, but many vegans, they will not date, marry, go out with people that are also not vegan, which really cuts down, but given the fact that they're less than 1%, at least in the United States, and 1% of people are vegans, that really cuts down your potential dating partners. And I've interviewed animal activists who's, you know, for example, whose marriage broke up because of, there are other things involved too, but this when one person suddenly becomes really involved in animal issues, and particularly if they become vegans. And yeah, the thing is, because you know, one of the things that that humans do in terms of social, our social interactions is they eat together, is have meals together. Mm-hmm. It's a major social thing. Those of us that are not vegans, we really don't know how to cook for vegans, and it can really cut back on your friends and lots of aspects of your life, as you know.
Yeah, it can make a big difference. But I mean, it is possible to learn and take an interest in cooking vegan food, even if you're not vegan. I mean, we've very much done that in our house. My husband is the cook in our house. He's a fabulous cook. Yeah. And when having my parents over for dinner, he wanted to make a real effort to make something nice, you know, that was vegan. And we've enjoyed it so much that we eat a lot of vegan food at home. We hardly ever have meat. We have fish maybe once a week, if that, but we hardly ever have any meat at home because we enjoy vegan and vegetarian food. When we go out for dinner, that's when we might choose meat. But at home, we eat a lot of vegetarian and vegan food. And that's done through a bit of research and passion for cooking and flavors, because that's kind of the argument. You can still have all the same flavors, even similar textures if you choose with vegan and vegetarian cooking. You don't have to compromise. You don't have to end up with a plate of kind of limp vegetables or anything. It doesn't need to be a sad plate of food like people imagine it should be.
That's absolutely true. And one of the places that's normally considered, been ranked one of the 10 best vegan restaurants in the United States, is in my town. And I happen to know the chef and the chef's wife is a colleague of mine. And so when we go over to that restaurant Plant in Asheville, the food is stunningly good. It's the best food in town.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that it's become more fashionable now. I mean, it seems like it wasn't that long ago where it was seen as kind of a bit strange to be vegan or to have those kind of restaurants or to make those kind of choices. But now, thankfully, it's a lot more fashionable accountable to care more about what we're putting into our bodies.
I think that's exactly true. And to me, one of the most interesting food issues on the horizon is sometimes called lab grown meat or cultured meat. And so lab grown meat is meat that's grown from animal cells, but they don't involve the death of an animal. And the interesting thing about that is that about half of people think that it's the idea is too disgusting to meat. The idea is basically genetically modified animal tissue that's grown in giant vats. And it's I'm personally, and like you, I'm a conflicted omnivore, and I am looking forward forward when I can go out and get a piece of test tube raised, vat raised, steak that tastes good, or a piece of chicken that tastes great. Although many of my vegetarian friends and a lot of my meat eating friends find that idea absolutely horrible.
Yeah. I found it fascinating so much when I was answering the questionnaire. There was a lot of questions where I was sort of laughing to myself because I knew the kind of answers that I wanted to give. And I imagined that a lot of people would automatically, yes, oh no, this is morally wrong, this is morally wrong. But in reality, they are not, or we are not in general, talking the talk or walking the walk. It's just about what we think and what we feel compared to what we do are very much not always the same.
That's absolutely true. And the thing that interests me, I mean, there's different reasons why people study human-animal interactions. Some people go into the field because they're animal lovers and they want to show and they want to do research on the impact of pets on health and things like that. But what drew me into this field was exactly what you're talking about. And I think we deal with these same moral issues, difficult moral issues in many aspects of our lives. But they, to me, looking at them in the context of our decisions about animals is particularly fruitful. It's just this, it offers us just wonderful window into the complexity of what it means to be a good person in a morally complicated world. And that's what sort of draws me to this. Like, and people are so passionate about animal issues. You know, they're so passionate about it. They bring out the best and the worst in human nature. And to me as a psychologist, that's all the reason in the world for studying this stuff.
Yeah. You
know, it's a window on what it means to be a human being.
One of the question examples that made me smile and I found very difficult to give an honest answer was the production of inexpensive meat, eggs, and dairy products justifies maintaining animals under crowded conditions. And you have to strongly agree, strongly disagree, or anything in between. And I read that statement and I thought, well, I obviously don't think that animals should be put in crowded conditions for the consumption of meat or dairy products at all. I felt uncomfortable with the idea of me saying, yeah, that's okay, that's fine. And I think most people, I'd expect, would read that and go, no, absolutely not. No, that's wrong. Animals should not be in crowded conditions. But how many people, when they're out buying meat in the supermarket, have a clue as to where that meat has come from and what conditions the animals have been in at all? And the idea of inexpensive, I mean, most people, I would again assume, are going to look at price when they're buying meat or animal products. And therefore, if something is a good price, a lot of people will think, oh, that's a good price, as opposed to, I wonder what condition that chicken was in order for it to be that price. Go on.
Yeah, chickens are a great example.
Yeah.
Because changing the ability to raise a chicken because of changes in the genetics of chickens and the use of antibiotics, which are not being used anymore, and intensive agriculture that's made chicken so cheap. And so chicken consumption has just absolutely skyrocketed in recent years. And it's because chicken can be made so cheaply, and it can only be made cheaply through these horrible factory farms. You can't raise chickens living out in a pasture to the degree that people want them and make it as cheap as it presently is.
We're all hypocrites, aren't we? basically.
I hate that word. I call it the H word. But yeah, I don't like to say it. But I think Jonathan Haidt and his book, his wonderful book on psychology of human morality, basically has a sentence where he says, the bottom line is that we're all hypocrites.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I like to say more that, the inconsistency is part of human nature, and we need to learn to live with it and make peace with it at some point. And we're all going to do it in different ways.
Yeah. I remember an ex-boyfriend of mine when I was at college, he said that when he was younger growing up, they in the countryside, they had two lambs that they looked after, and they would feed with the view that they were going to have them killed and eat them. And I found this concept extremely difficult to cope with and thought it was horrendous, to be honest. But at the same time, there was a part of me that thought, well, they're looking after these animals. They know where the meat is coming from. And therefore, surely that is better than just buying it wrapped up in a piece of plastic from the supermarket. It's just the fact that most people could not. I mean, they even named them, they named these animals, they were feeding them, they were looking after them, albeit outside in the field, looking after them as pets. And then the next minute, months after doing so, they're sitting on their dining plate. And it's just such a weird concept, but it's almost a better way of doing it, dare I say it? I don't know.
Well, that's a good point. And let me give another example of that. A friend of mine is a biologist, and he studies animals, and he's also a hunter, and he hunts deer and he hunts turkey, and he gets all his meat from animals that he hunts. And most Americans approve of hunting, but not nearly as many as approve of meat. There's only about 10% of Americans that hunt. But if you actually look at the ethics of meat eating, it seems to me that hunting is a much more defensible way of getting your food. If you're and I'm not a hunter, by the way, it's a much more morally defensible way that animal had a better life. And if you're a very careful shot and a good shot, the lights go out after it's lived its life in the woods, and that's vastly better than the life of an industrial chicken.
Absolutely. It's just most people couldn't do it. But yet they'd happily eat it. They couldn't kill the animal, but they'd happily eat it.
Right.
Oh, it's such a fascinating subject. It's been great to have you on the program. Thank you so much, Hal. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. It's by Hal Herzog, who we've been chatting with today. Hal, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
TRE.